Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Dan Clayton.
And I'm Jill Lavender.
Hello and welcome to part two of our language and gender special. This arose out of a Twitter conversation with teachers expressing their frustrations about how students frequently approach language and gender productively in their answers, whether that be in NEA investigations or whether that be in response to particular exam questions at A level. So today's episode is very much aimed at teachers and trying to grapple with the particularly thorny issues of how we take big conceptual debates about gender and identity and where it meets the really practical issues of teaching it to students and getting students themselves to produce really useful answers or investigations based on language and gender. So I guess what we wanted to start with first is an acknowledgement, a sort of a big disclaimer that, of course, contexts differ for lots of us. Some of us teach for different exam boards, and that will impact quite massively on the way that we approach language and gender as a topic. Different boards have got different requirements of the questions, for example. AQA kind of goes for big conceptual, sort of discursive essay-based questions, particularly on paper two, that don't have any data attached to them, whereas both EdXL and OCR, for example, do have data-based questions where gender may play one small part of a wider answer. That will, of course, play really largely into the way that teachers choose to approach it as a topic and as ways of teaching. Equally, of course, as teachers, you will be amending things for the class of students that are in front of you. You may have very high ability students who grasp conceptual ideas very quickly. You may have students who need a bit more support. So, of course, all of this stuff is working in the background of the things that we're talking about today. So we'll try our very, very best to try and navigate a path through language and gender as a topic. And this is what we've attempted to do this morning. The fact that we've been together for quite some time already trying to figure it out is indicative of how difficult it is as a topic, we think. And our general sense is that there is a favoured approach that staff seem to like to take when tackling language and gender, be that for NEA, for non-exam investigative projects, or whether it be for as a standalone topic or a connected topic as part of prepping students for exam questions and considering ideas around exams. So the common approach seems to be to work in sort of a chronological and linear fashion through the development of language and gender and language and gender theory through time, sort of known as the sort of the D's model, the three D's model, or even the four D's model. Shall we talk through what that looks like?
Yeah, so certainly, I mean, when I've done exam marking for AQA, and Dan will be the same, quite often we'll come across the deficit model, the dominance model, the difference model, and then sometimes you get the diversity model, and sometimes you get the similarities model, which doesn't have a D. But they seem to be the way that a lot of teachers and a lot of students are kind of organizing ideas around language and gender.
Yeah, and with good reason, right? And we've talked about this quite a lot together, is that that model offers a lot, especially for students who need support. It's straightforward. It works, as I said, sort of chronologically through time, and therefore shows the development of ideas about language and gender, linking them directly one through to the next, so you can see sort of direct impact of one on the other, sort of starting with Lakov in sort of the 1973, and then moving through into the sort of the 80s, the 90s, and into more recent research there at the end. And the model has a lot to offer, doesn't it?
I think, yeah, it does. I think part of the issue, if you're looking at it from a sort of what you see at the end perspective as like as marking it, I think, you know, as a teacher or examiner or whatever, you often kind of see a version of something you might have taught from students, and that will work its way through in different sort of structures and different models. And I think one of the things you often tend to see, and I don't think it's particularly helpful, is you get working through the kind of D's. So it's deficit. Well, that's Robin Lakoff, and she said this. Then you get dominance, and that's Zimmerman and West, and they said this. And then you get difference, and that's Deborah Tannen, and she said this. And then you get diversity, and that's Deborah Cameron or Janet Hyde, and they said this. And it's fine. I mean, you get something for each, but you're not seeing necessarily, you're not getting that kind of narrative overview of exactly what happened to make the sort of thinking about gender and language move on, or even how they might kind of interconnect. So I think there's sometimes a bit of a sort of reductionist model, which ends up with some students, right? Now, that doesn't mean that's necessarily how it's taught at all. And I do think as well, going back to sort of Lisa's point at the start, you know, teachers are in very different situations, not just in the students they teach, but also in the experience they've got. And, you know, loads of language teachers for A-level come from lit backgrounds and are new to teaching language. Mm-hmm. I've never had a grounding in linguistics and are kind of doing all of this on the hoof a bit. I know I certainly was when I first started teaching English language. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to sort of upskill and up knowledge, is that a word? But anyway, boost your own knowledge about these things.
We've just made it happen, though. Knowledge.
Made fetch happen. But you've got, you know, and so you may well be kind of looking through old notes or PowerPoints that you've been provided from someone more experienced in your department, and they may well have left like 20, 30 years ago, or they may be floating around as resources you always use. And some of that stuff is really outdated. But yeah, I think the D's kind of work to some extent. And I think when you kind of look at them, they provide that nice little kind of narrative. And particularly when we talked to Deborah Cameron last week about this, you know, she talked through the sort of development of thinking about gender. She talks about that in The Myth of Mars and Venus too. And, you know, lots of other people. So Jennifer Coates in Women, Men and Language, Helen Saunson in Researching Language, Gender and Sexuality, and Jane Sunderland in Language and Gender all have got a nice kind of overview of that sort of stuff. They contextualize it. But I think sometimes that kind of narrative gets a bit lost in the mix for some students.
As is often the case, because teaching is really, really tricky, right? And even with the best will in the world, a delightfully sort of nuanced approach to the 4D model can still trickle down as something that's quite reductive when it comes out to the other end.
Yeah.
And that's to some extent the way it goes. So I guess what we wanted today was to try and think about if we were to adapt the sort of 4D model, if that was something that you wanted to go with, how could we do that? And if you had a real interest in this and have the time and inclination to throw it out altogether and wanted to take an alternative approach, then what the alternatives are. So yeah. We've talked a little bit about what would be, if you wanted to retain an element of sort of the 4D approach, what could you do that would update some of the things that we dealt with in the last episode, the try and avoid an over-reliance on Lakoff as kind of a cornerstone of students' understanding. How could we focus more on recent theoretical developments and research? And what kind of approaches could we take to the teaching of it that would maybe foreground the things that we want and minimize the things that we don't necessarily want?
Yeah. Jackie's got quite a good system of using different Ds, haven't you?
Yeah, so one thing that I've tried, and we'll have to see how it comes out when my students get into their exams, and I have used the 4Ds, but I've kind of renamed them a little bit. So I start with the idea of the dated deficit model, and then we move on to the disputed dominance model before we look at the dangerous difference model, and then we move into the diversity model. So with that, what I'm trying to push is the idea of criticality and encouraging the students to not necessarily take it as read that these approaches are some kind of universal truth about language and gender, but they are approaches that we can have a look at. We can look at their methodologies. We can look at alternative research that challenges some of the ideas that are kind of held within these approaches. So just to get students more overtly critical of the models when they talk about them.
Yeah, and we talked about how important this was as an approach generally, not just for gender, but for any sort of research that you're discussing with students, is to front load the idea of evaluation, that any bit of research that you put in front of students is something that they should get into the habit of challenging, that they should immediately consider how far the methodology is robust, how far the findings can be generalized, and whether that's useful or whether it's not, you know, the context in which that research has happened, and modifying the 4D model to have just those words in front of the Ds, for example, can automatically trigger that for them in a way that could be really helpful. And with minimal sort of tweaking from a teacher who's spent, you know, a long time building the 4D models and has all of their resources sort of based on it.
You can pair up Lakoff's intuitions about the use of tag questions with Cameron's study that looked at the use of tag questions, but her kind of, you know, data set was huge and found, you know, came to very different conclusions.
I suppose the other approach, isn't it, is to do the 4Ds, but do them in a different order. And that's certainly been suggested by some people, isn't it? And I think Claire Feeney, who teaches in the Northeast, was talking about that as a way she approaches it, maybe.
Yeah, Claire's got a really lovely and very detailed suggestion kind of thread on the Lexis podcast Twitter feed. So do go and have a look. But it's a lovely idea of sort of front loading the more recent research or starting with something really, really current. She actually recommends, this is going to sound really self-congratulatory, but she actually starts with Alexa's podcast episode. We did a lovely interview with Lucy Jones, who's at Nottingham, I believe.
Yeah.
Episode 10 with Lucy Jones from Nottingham, where she talks about her own research into language and gender identities and sexuality. Really, really lovely research to have a look at with students, but also kind of name checks a whole bunch of different bits from Podesva's study on gender, sexuality, identity, and language use as well. And she recommends starting there and then using that as sort of a jumping off point to go and look at other more recent research first as a starting point.
And from a really practical point of view, when students are writing their responses in time conditions, I often find that they just run out of steam or run out of time if they're working their way through.
Yes.
You know, the older days, there's no time left for the diversity model. And you think, oh, that's, you know, that's the stuff that we're really interested in. So maybe flipping it on its head would mean that students would spend longer looking at more current cutting edge research. That might be another consideration.
Yeah. And I think another good thing that's tied in with this as well is that does all of that more recent stuff. The diversity model is much more about performance of identity. It problematizes gender as a binary. It kind of challenges the idea that, well, some sort of, I guess, common sense quote marks ideas around gender. And that's a really good way of actually kind of instilling a bit more evaluative and sort of critical thinking in those earlier models. Because, you know, of course, one of the arguments the sort of more recent waves of gender research have put forward is that, you know, some of the very early work on it, and this goes into like the 90s as well, very much assumed that gender was a reality, a fact, that it was something that was just done, you know, that men and women use language in different ways. And it's, I think, the more that's kind of gone on thinking about this, the more it is that, you know, gender is constructed through language. It's not something out there in the first place that just needs to be discovered. I think that's maybe what sort of Deborah Cameron talked about as well last week. But this sort of sense that if you can start with that idea and saying, okay, well, look, here's where we are now. Here are some of the ideas that are really kind of contemporary that people are thinking about, that, you know, we aren't just male or female. We do male and female identities, plural, in different situations. And there are many different identities, and they're culturally established, some of them linked to sex, but other ones linked to very different sort of social cultural ideas about how it is to perform an identity within a society within certain parameters, and then challenging those things and going back to the early research saying, okay, now we've got those ideas, well, what do you make of this notion from, say, Robin Lakoff sitting there thinking, okay, well, maybe women do this and men do this. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, and there's something to be said, of course, for particularly those of us who are working with exam boards where gender kind of overlays with other aspects of identity, because that's what the demands of the question asks, to not start with, you know, gender theory, but to start with elements of representation, to start by looking at current articles, to look at, you know, Daily Mail articles, to look at, you know, tweets from people, you know, responding to things about gender or about gender identities or about, you know, how this sports presenter is talking in the World Cup or whatever it is, as a way in, and then you bring the theory in slightly later. So just a question for you both then. If there is a teacher listening who's thinking, right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to reverse my sort of 4Ds. I'm going to start with the more recent first. What kinds of things should they think about putting in that kind of bucket of the more recent and useful research? Which bits of theory should they really be talking about, do we think?
I think if we're thinking about performance and identity, that's a really good place to start, because it allows you to kind of overlap between what might be different topics. So, for example, you know, we look at language and ethnicity, but within that, there are also opportunities to look at research that's been done, which considers how gender identities can have an impact on, you know, the way that people speak. So, for example, a lovely resource that's out there from Devyani Sharma, she's from Queen Mary University.
Yeah, QMUL. It's Teach Real English, isn't it?
Teach Real English, yeah, which is a brilliant resource. And there's lots of recordings there of different people, different ages, in different contexts. You know, some research that she's done fairly recently looks at the Punjabi social roles within people living in West London, and finding things like, you know, older men with kind of wider business contacts and having been kind of politically active, interacting with British community and then South Asian communities back home, were very good at code switching, and, you know, their language style was very different to women of a similar age. But then when they looked at younger speakers, she found that the younger generation had different experiences, and that seemed to play out in the language that they were using. So, for example, younger female speakers had wider social networks and liked to have contact inside and outside their community. So they would do volunteering, for example, whereas young boys were trying to establish peer groups and street status within the neighbourhood. And therefore, you know, the language that they use seemed to be less fluid in terms of kind of changing from one particular style of language to another. So there you've got that kind of intersectionality that I think is really interesting. And the materials that are available are really engaging for students to listen to and to start to kind of unpick and discuss.
Yeah, that's teaching unit 17, being Asian in London, ethnicity, gender and social networks on Teach Real English. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. And that's based on Devyani Sharma's work from 2011 in West London. There's some really, I mean, it's all kind of nicely put together to use straight away in lessons. That,
yeah, really accessible. Yeah,
yeah, and like you say, with kind of audio clips as well. So it's kind of you can hear the data.
What other more recent ones do we have?
Well, I think one that it's not exactly recent, but I think it's really useful is to actually go back to Jennifer Coates' book, Women, Men, and Language. So the third edition of that came out in 2016, and there's a really nice bit at the end of that where she talks about sort of future directions for gender research. So she draws on stuff that have been happening around that time, looks ahead. And she says one of the big things to look at is Judith Butler's work in her book, basically Gender Trouble in 1990. And I think that's a really important part of establishing this kind of diversity, sort of social constructionist sort of model of thinking about language and gender. And there's a really nice bit at the end. It's only a few pages long, the final bit. And I think for teachers, it's a really good one to have a look at, to kind of refresh your memory or just kind of see it in a nice, clearly summarized kind of way. And she says, you know, in her influential book, Gender Trouble, Judith Butler argues that gender is something that is done and that it is something that has to be done over and over again. Gender is the repeated stylization of the body, a set of repeated acts within a rigid regulatory framework, which congeal over time to produce the appearance of substance of a natural kind of being. And she goes on to sort of explain that and sort of, you know, kind of extrapolate some of the ideas there in relation to language and gender research. And then she kind of talks a bit later on, she moves on to saying, you know, the challenge of the binary distinction between being a man or being a woman, binary pairs such as man, woman, male, female, masculine, feminine, distort and oversimplify our thinking. That's really interesting, again, because what that does is it establishes that sort of critical framework, mm-hmm. doesn't it? To go and go back to the earlier stuff where gender really wasn't being challenged at all, was being mm-hmm. accepted as here's what men do, here's what women do.
Yeah,
I guess, you know, what Deborah Cameron was saying was that Robin Lakoff kind of fired the starting gun for some of that thinking that's then got on.
Yeah.
And we don't want to give her too much of a hard time for this, given what Deborah was saying the other week. But I think it's interesting to kind of then, you know, apply some of that and think about it. So that's the Jennifer Coates one. And she's also got some really nice stuff there where she talks a bit about other changes. So she talks about how communities of practice approaches led to some really interesting thinking about gender.
That's a super useful one, because communities of practice branches over lots of aspects of social identities, not just gendered ones, but occupational ones, power-based ones, ethnicity-based ones, class-based ones. Really, really helpful kind of approach as a whole to take. Again, especially if you work on exam questions that span kind of social and personal identities, like the EdExcel questions, for example, or the OCR ones that look, I think, at representation a little bit as well. Coming back to the Judith Butler really briefly, in my experience, students really enjoy getting into that conceptually because it feels quite sort of straightforward for them, the idea that gender is something that you do rather than something that you are. What they typically find really difficult, though, is finding really specific examples to tie it to, because unlike with some other bits of research, there's no kind of AO1 features for them to drill down to. So what I generally find is that I have to go and then make some links for them, or give them some examples of the ways in which gender can be performed really specifically in terms of AO1 features. And that's where things like Devyani Sharma's research can come in, or some of the other more recent ones where you can tie ideas together, big conceptual ideas to very specific AO1 features that they can then talk about in detail.
Yeah, I think actually I was listening back to the Lucy Jones interview that you mentioned before, and I think she does a really good job of explaining some of that. And that's, you know, with some really practical examples from her research. So that's kind of performance of gender, sexuality, identity. Yeah. And I think that's maybe the other thing to think about is if you want to kind of upend the 4D kind of approach, or, you know, just kind of think of another way of doing it, then we did raise this question with Deborah Cameron in the interview last week about, well, should we really call this language and gender? Should we maybe be talking about it as language and identity? And I think from her perspective, the answer was basically no. But I do think from a kind of A-level teaching perspective, you could argue that because of the way gender fits into this sort of intersectional approach, particularly on the AQA spec, I think, where you think maybe also OCR and EdExcel when you're talking about that, those particular components where you get some data about identity.
It's literally called the identity question on EdExcel.
Yeah. I think those do offer a way to kind of say, okay, well, look, there are loads of different ways in which we as individuals and as members of groups express our identity through language. Yeah. Gender is one part of that. And we can see those connections. But of course, then you come back to, well, we've got to teach some language and gender practically. Lots of teachers want to kind of have topics that they go through. But I think if you map out the connections between those and show the intersectional nature of it, every time you do one of those, like language and age, language and regional diversity, language and gender, you can say, okay, but let's see how these connect. And I think there are some studies, you know, like Emma Moore's work in Bolton, that's great for tying those things together. You can have a look, for example, at the stuff like Penny Eckert has done.
Yeah.
You know, the Detroit High School study, that stuff. Yeah, they're really good for showing those connections.
Yeah. I tend to signal those. I've got a little cluster of studies like that basically map across different identities and kind of have big sort of highlighted stars next to them, so students know that they can use them in lots of different questions, not just necessarily a gender one.
It's
an interesting thing about the, you know, do we want to talk about gender, do we want to talk about identity? I think there's definitely a case for talking about identity broadly as A-level English teachers. I think Debbie Cameron's argument was, if we talk about identity, we lose some of the urgency of needing to talk about misogyny and sexism.
I think that was her fear.
Although there is definitely space for that. So if we are looking for an alternative to the 4Ds model, if you are forging a new path and going into something, you know, genuinely different, then one thing that came out of our conversation with Debbie in the last episode was this idea of looking at the different branches of language and gender research rather than working sort of chronologically through time. Instead, consider the different approaches to language and gender. So the 4 sort of major options, and of course there are others, but we've tried to sort of cluster them together under some examples that we have, is that you can look at language and gender under the variationist research model. People that are doing research under the corpus linguistics or through the corpus linguistics kind of research methods, those that are looking at language and gender through representation, so how gender is represented, or those that are looking specifically at contextual factors and how the real specifics of context can impact ideas and notions of gender and possibly gender performance, if we're looking at it from that way. So I think we've got a couple of examples under each of these that you may decide that you want to have a look at. We've got researchers that are looking at varieties across sort of population level. So they're, as Debbie said in the last episode, frequently they're looking at kind of small phonological changes and small phonological production. So we're looking at sort of Treadgill and Treadgill's Norwich study. We're looking at things like
Lebove.
Both the kind of, you know, fourth floor department store study, but also Martha's Vineyard, because you've got the whole kind of idea of like performance of identity there, I suppose, as well. That's quite interesting, because that's kind of a bit first wavy. There's the Emma Moore one we talked about. So her Bolton study, we looked at basically kind of use of was, were.
Eckert's study around age and around kind of teenage identities. There was a gendered element to that as well.
There's a really nice book by Peter Stockwell called Sociolinguistics. It's got a really good section in it, which looks at recent research. I think it was often done by some of his postgrads. So, for example, looking at swearing as used by men and women. I think it might even have been colour terms. There were nice little kind of short studies there.
We've also, of course, got the Milroy studies of open and closed networks in Belfast. So that there were gendered elements to that as well, even though they were often looking at kind of social network and social network strength. And there's quite a lot of variationist studies that actually looked at things like class, but ended up, because they were looking, for example, at standard and non-standard features of having gendered elements, that kind of came out as side findings, even though they weren't, you know, officially looking at gender. So there's lots of options there in the sort of variationist sort of pot, if you like. And then we've got this idea of looking at corpus and corpus methods as a way to look at language and gender. So what kind of things can we look at there?
Yeah, I mean, there's really kind of interesting stuff done by Corpus the Schools, who are based up at Lancaster University. And we talked to Dana Gablasova a couple of years ago about the work that she had done as part of that and about the use of corpora. So the Corpus for Schools project has got some really good stuff. And if you go to their website, where you can find, I think, 3 worksheets and exercises for gender, they basically kind of, essentially, they kind of say, okay, you might have like a hunch about language being used differently. Now let's see what the corpus tells us about this. And it's a really nice way of saying, okay, let's think about those kind of things and see, well, do they actually occur? Are, you know, men doing this more than women? And how do we then sort of subdivide that, maybe by looking at things like social class, age and the like?
Before you go on though, Dan, can we just say that on that website as well, there's really helpful student handouts and teaching notes that are just, you know, that there's made to pick up and run with. So that's always good.
They've got even answer sheets, isn't it?
They have got
it. Really helpful. And there's also, Paul Baker wrote a really good article for E! Magazine a few years ago around, well, it was called Using a Corpus to Analyse Gender and Language. And he talks about sort of a brief intro to corpus linguistics. And then he says, basically, looking at usage first, it's notable that a lot of the early work on the ways that men and women or boys and girls use language is focused on differences. Some of the earlier studies make quite provocative claims, yet have been based on small numbers of speakers. But he says, we can now use 8 million words of spoken language data from the British National Corpus. And here's what we find. Well, we actually find more evidence for similarity than difference. And it's great because it's those, it's that way in which, you know, corpus analysis is allowed to really kind of get the bigger picture. It's a really good piece. And he talks through, it's, you know, aimed at students, this one. So we'll put a link into the show notes. It's one that's behind the EMAG paywall. So you do need to have an e-magazine subscription for that.
Things like that are really useful because, of course, people like Deborah Cameron have whole articles written about how, you know, the findings of lots of research around gender actually finds that there are far more similarities than differences. It just doesn't make headlines.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to be able to tie together large branches of language and gender research where actually they say exactly the same thing, which is that the idea of differences, fundamental differences between men's and women's language are largely unfounded.
Yeah, yeah.
So moving on from the corpus stuff then, we've also got this idea, and perhaps the most rich and potentially the most interesting in terms of the ways that we can engage students is looking at how gender is represented. So the idea of language and gender via research into representation.
Yeah, I think it could even be a really good starting point, couldn't it? Because there are so many articles or texts out there that represent women's language particularly in particular ways. And I think that using something that is current to then reflect back on, you know, the history of language and gender might be a really good starting point. So, you know, articles that tell women that they are apologizing too much or that they shouldn't be using vocal fry, or their use of exclamation marks is making them look unprofessional in the workplace, I think are all, you know, there are so many of them that you can, you know, you can easily find that provide a really good starting point to start thinking about these issues.
Yeah. I think it ties into that thing we were just talking about before we started recording, wasn't it? About the kind of cycle. So that sort of representation of how women use language feeds into that sort of self-perception, which then kind of changes the way you view your own language and makes you very self-conscious about speaking in a certain way, you know, using online messaging in a certain way. It comes back to this idea of the double bind that you see kind of mentioned quite a lot in writing about this. So that sense in which there's a perception that if you perform language in a certain way, you'll be judged harshly for it. But of course, if you don't, then you're judged in another way. Yeah. And so in a way, women can't win.
Yeah. And really good, that sort of angle to it is really useful for stretching your more able students into starting to look at Whorfian ideas about language determinism, language reflectionism. How far does women's language reflect things that they've been told about women's language, and how far is it inherent? And of course, that's one of the big kind of, you know, debates that sat under a lot of feminist idea and feminist thought that came out of the 60s and 70s and then have sort of morphed into these various different branches.
Although I think, again, as you're saying, those may be kind of quite old ideas and maybe definitely ones that I think you could evaluate and say, okay, well, you know, basically that stuff's not really happening. It's more complicated. I think it does come back to those ideas. Again, we've talked to people like Eleanor Cimino about that idea of metaphor and how metaphor can kind of frame and shape the way you think. And that's probably that to me is a lot more convincing. But then again, we often see women's talk described in those terms, and we do see that kind of those kind of discourses around it. And I guess this is really crucial, isn't it? Loads of the people who write about this stuff talk about the idea that to talk about gender and language is far too simplistic, both from a sort of gender binary point of view, but also language is much more complicated than just the words we use. Language, you know, someone like Jennifer Coates talks about, and Jane Sunderland as well, about discourses. There are discourses around us all the time about women's language, men's language, gender differences.
Yeah.
And that's really important to get into because, as we said, it links back.
is another useful one to cross over into other areas of language study. So if you're looking, for example, at power, and you're looking at Fairclough and discourses within language and behind, is it within discourse and behind discourse, for example, and notions of power and how power, you know, institutions of power are constructed through texts, then representation and looking at language and gender through representation is a really great way to do that. Debbie Cameron referenced some research on rape reporting in the British press, if you wanted to go down, you know, a more serious route with your students.
Yeah, that was Alessia Trancasi, wasn't it?
I think
from the show notes for the last episode.
Yeah, equally the one on looking at talk time in Disney films, so literally about kind of the amount of time that, you know, gendered characters get in Disney movies is a really straightforward way into looking at things like that with students.
Yeah.
And then finally, this idea of kind of, I guess you might, what might have been called is still called interactionist studies. The idea of looking at very, very specific contextual factors that may impact the way that language and gender are performed in individual conversations.
Sylvia Shaw did some really interesting research on the language of MPs. Mm-hmm. Can you think when that was? Anybody?
Yeah.
It was a couple of years ago. I think we referenced it in the interview with Debbie. They wrote a book together about about the TV debates in the run-up to a UK general election a few years ago. And they actually kind of did a featured analysis of what is frequently considered sort of male/female features. So things like interruptions, things like tag questions, things like collaborative verbs, talk time, you know, things that are considered combative or cooperative. And they mapped them really carefully and found, you know, that in evidence base, that the male and female MPs were broadly similar. And if anything, the female MPs, so people like Nicola Sturgeon, for example, were using what would traditionally be called quite combative, sort of inverted commas, male specific sort of language features, but that the reporting of the debates still said that the women were more cooperative, more collaborative, gentler, you know, things like that. So essentially the reporting on the debates did not match the evidence of what the debates themselves showed. Yeah. And that was a really, really interesting study. We'll get the name of the book for you as well and put that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's 2016, Gender, Power and Political Speech, Women and Language in the 2015 UK General Election.
And I guess this kind of links to some of the things that we would traditionally have used in the 4D model of looking at things like the Obar and Atkins study that looked at courtrooms, but not looking at it specifically through a dominance sort of view, but instead looking at it as a very context-specific production of ideas about speech.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that I think most applies to students' language investigation, is just to sort of move it on to that kind of thing, is I guess one of my frustrations with this is that, having gone through lots of this gender stuff and talked about the evaluative kind of approach we need to take and being sort of critical about these things, what often happens is when students start a language investigation and they kind of think, okay, I'm going to be looking for gender differences in the ways that certain people communicate in a certain situation. So let's say, for example, very popular stuff like analysing the language of The Apprentice, Love Island, Dragon's Den, some kind of semi-scripted TV thing, or even analysing, you know, conversations among their friends. If you get in your head there's going to be gender difference, that's what you look for. And that's what you end up kind of falling back on all the time, when in fact, what would be more useful is actually looking at all of the different contextual factors and thinking really closely about things around power, about relationships, around, you know, the interests people have. And not just kind of assuming that there's going to be differences because it's about being male and being female. And even if there are differences about being male and female, it's about how those aspects of male and femaleness are kind of performed in certain ways. There's loads of rich stuff in Love Island, for example, to look at around that. But yeah, I mean, I just think with language investigations, there's a tendency to kind of fall back into just relying on the same old theorists. And I think that's where there's really rich scope to kind of draw on this stuff that's a bit more context specific. And actually, to talk about the context, particularly when you think about the AQA language investigation, 20 of those marks out of the 50 are available for AO3, which is language in context, meanings in context. Mm. And that's super important when you actually link what people are saying to what they're trying to do in a situation, the social meanings of what they're trying to do. And it goes way beyond just saying, okay, well, this person has used this empty adjective and that fits with what Robin Lakoff said. There's much more interesting and relevant stuff to say about that kind of thing.
So we hope that's useful. Obviously, we don't have all of the answers here, and these are, of course, suggestions. But if you do take anything from today, and if you do try it out with students, if you do have any successes or even failures, please do let us know, because we'd love to hear from our teacher listening base. And of course, you can get in touch through the Lexis Podcast Twitter feed.